Hello, my friends. It's Monday, June 9th, 2025, and I'm your host, Radical Russ Belleville, your Red State Refugee, and welcome to the Radical Russ Show, coming to you from Rolla J Studios in my undisclosed mountain hideaway in the beautiful state of Jefferson region of Southern Oregon. On this week's Smoke Session, the Trump regime sends Gestapo to Los Angeles for the Battle of Home Depot. ABC News journalist Terry Moran is suspended for honesty. The world's two biggest narcissists break up over the big, beautiful, face-eating leopard's bill. Democrats try everything to woo voters except believing in something. Gay people are being erased during Pride Month, figuratively and literally. My analysis on pop music's home run singers, and a radical rant about rejecting snitch culture. But before we get to all that, I've got three quick hits for you. First of all, I was posting the other day on Blue Sky. I saw a post come across from one of my favorite rappers of all time, Public Enemy's Flava Flav, who posted, "I'm probably going to get in trouble for doing this, but I'm going to do it anyways. I keep seeing y'all stealing my Raising Cane's cutouts and taking me to cool places. Do it. Whoever steals me and takes me on the best adventure this summer, I'm going to pick one of you and take you to Cane's with me." And then there's various pictures of people who have his cardboard cutout, Flava Flav with the clock, and he's got the Raisin Cane's jacket on, and they're at parties and stuff with the cardboard cutout. So I posted that. I did a quote post of that and said, "Rapper Flava Flav encourages lawlessness among the youth. More news at 11. And folks, Flava Flav liked it. Woohoo! Yay, I got a like from Flava Flav. The more news at 11, of course, a hint back to Apocalypse 91, The Enemy Strikes Black, for those of you who are hip-hop aficionados. Next up, I wanted to let you know about a little thing I'm doing on my social media account lately. I saw a post from somebody who was lamenting having to drop their subscription services, you know, Netflix, Amazon Prime, that kind of stuff, just because the economy is so bad. And, you know, they were just sad about not being able to find something to watch. And so as someone who has lived in poverty most of my life, I'm pretty good at finding free stuff to watch. And that has led me to starting my new hashtag up on my Blue Sky account at RadicalRust.com, hashtag Tubi TV Night. There's this great little free app out there called Tubi, T-U-B-I. And I'm not shilling for them. This isn't an ad or anything. I just like it. It's free and you can watch all sorts of movies on it. And so you can follow that hashtag Tubi TV Night from my account, and I'll give you some picks to watch throughout the week. And this week, I found all sorts of really interesting things. First of all, from 1975, the movie That's the Way of the World. It features Earth, Wind, and Fire and a young Harvey Keitel. The movie itself, not so great, but being able to see Harvey Keitel is so young and the members of Earth, Wind, and Fire so young, it was kind of fun to watch that one. They've also got a few of the seasons of the ABC show Fridays, the 80s show that tried to compete with NBC's Saturday Night Live, which is mostly forgettable for the sketches. But it did feature Michael Richards, who went on to be in Seinfeld. And I had forgotten that on Fridays was Larry David. He was very prominently featured on the show. I had totally forgotten about that. So from Curb Your Enthusiasm, of course. And there were some great musical guests. There were some Devo, Journey, Boz Scaggs. Worth it just to check out the musical guests. The 2015 movie Pixels, I had never seen before. This was a Josh Gad and Adam Sandler flick. Kind of, you know, a couple video gamers that save the world. Okay as movies go. The 2019 feature Color Out of Space, an adaptation of an H.P. Lovecraft science fiction horror kind of genre, starring Nicolas Cage. I didn't follow it so well. I didn't know exactly what was going on it. But the movie this week that really surprised me was a movie from 2013 starring Brooke Shields called The Hot Flashes. And it features Brooke Shields as a woman who puts together a group of menopausal ladies who were former basketball stars in the 80s and 90s to take on the current state champs as a charity game to save a breast cancer. Yada, yada, yada. Doesn't matter. Brooke Shields is in it. Wanda Sykes is in it. Daryl Hannah is in it. Cameron Manheim is in it. Virginia Madsen is in it. And Eric Roberts is an amazing cast. Each one of the cast members has their own little story arc. And it's pleasant. It's kind of if predictable movie, but it's nice and pleasant. I think you'd get an enjoyment out of watching 2013's The Hot Flashes on hashtag Tubi TV Night. For our last quick hit, I want to make note of this past week, June 6th, was, of course, the 81st anniversary of the Allied landing on Normandy, D-Day, as we call it. Not just Normandy Beach, the Canadians landing at Juneau Beach and many other beaches, but, of course, Omaha Beach, the Americans. So much sacrifice that was given by the World War II, the greatest generation, to fight fascism over there. So we wouldn't have to fight it over here. And it's just so disappointing and disillusioning that we're having to fight it over here in the United States of America, and that our current president and the people that support him do not understand what America is all about and why we landed on those beaches to fight the Nazis. It just sickens me to see Nazi flags flying here in the United States and people who stand up for Gestapo tactics and disappearing people and othering people and dehumanizing people are saluting the same flag that our fighting men and women fought to defend, whether it had 48 stars, 58 stars, 50 stars, or however many stars. That's our flag. And it's just sickening that the memory of those men who gave their lives on that beach is being so sullied today. So thoughts go out, and most honor I can imagine goes out to all of the World War II veterans, those who are still alive, still a few of them that are still alive, and their family members and descendants. Never forget their sacrifice. At least some of us Americans won't. On a lighter note, June 6th was also the 50th anniversary of the convoy. Yeah, the convoy, you know, Rubber Duck, Sodbuster, Pigpen. It was the dark of the moon on the 6th of June in a Kenworth pulling logs. That's right, 50 years since the song Convoy hit number one in 1975. And I was a kid at the time, and God, was I into the trucker stuff. I had the little 10 codes list all memorized, and I watched Convoy and listened to Red Sovine and all these other trucker hymns from the 70s and 60s and 50s before that, the old country songs. Happy 50th anniversary. Happy Convoy Day to everyone. This weekend, I've been glued to the television, the ABC News live feed from Los Angeles, showing the Battle of Home Depot, the occupation of Los Angeles by the Gestapo, ICE, and the federalization of California National Guard members by the Trump regime to put down protests that have taken place over these ICE abductions. As I understood what was going down, is ICE went to Paramount, California, among other places in the Los Angeles region, and tried to conduct an ICE raid of the day laborers who are waiting around trying to get work at a local Home Depot. And the community has reacted in Los Angeles, you know, putting up barricades and trying to stop these ICE agents from being able to conduct their work. Trump is escalating this by federalizing the National Guard. And I was just glued to the TV watching what was going on, seeing the helicopter footage. Maybe you've seen the clip now of the young man with the backpack being surrounded by LAPD on horseback. Maybe it was sheriffs, I'm not sure, but they're on horseback and they've got the horses spinning around and kicking the guy, throwing him to the ground. We're seeing the videos of the police shooting rubber bullets and tear gas canisters into the crowds, fires being started by the tear gas canisters themselves, reporters from Australia and England being shot by the rubber bullets by cops you can see that are purposefully aiming at them. The lawless regime is out of control. They believe they can get away with it. They're acting as if they don't think they're going to be any more free and fair elections in this country. And to see them all masked up, not identifying themselves, this is just going to spiral and get worse. And I believe that's the intention. I believe the administration's intention is to provoke and intimidate and make this get worse so that they can invoke the Insurrection Act and declare martial law. And if they think tightening the screws is going to work, they don't know how America works. First of all, Los Angeles and California are largely Hispanic populations, and many people who have come not just from Mexico, but whose families have lived in the California area when it was Mexico in the past. It's the border came over them. They didn't come over the border. And all of this response, this mass deportations now, I saw a post up on Blue Sky that kind of summed this up, which was how the Democrats and getting tough on immigration, you know, we'll put forth the most conservative bill. Senator Lankford's even for this bill. They totally have abandoned any idea of standing for immigration and immigration being a good thing and welcoming people into this country, and tried to be Republican light. Oh, yes, we all agree the immigration's bad. It's terrible that we have immigration. We'll just do it better than the Republicans. I posted that the Democratic Party on immigration is like a 7-year-old's soccer team, you know, when all the kids are running to where the ball is instead of running to where the ball is going to go. Because the average American, when they think about the immigration issue, as someone on Blue Sky noted, and you can find it on my feed, that the basic position is deport the bad ones and keep the good ones. That's what most Americans believe when it comes to immigrants. Yeah, when you get a case like the Lake and Riley case, you get some illegal immigrant who's come in and committed crimes, murders, whatever, deport those guys. Absolutely deport those guys. But the guys who cut my grass, the guys we pick up at the Home Depot to help on a roofing job, the guys that are washing the dishes in the kitchen, the women that are changing the bed linens at the hotel, no, don't deport them. They're the good ones. Consuela, she takes care of my kids. She's fine. They're the good ones. Don't deport the good ones. And that's the problem with thinking like that, is that the good ones is all a subjective measure, and you can't base a policy on a subjective measure like that. We need to get behind the idea, Democrats, that we support the underdog, that we fight for the underdog. We try to include and assimilate and expect more in this country, that we want to bring people into this country, that they contribute to this country. The only immigrant in this country who's taking anything away from us Americans is Elon Musk, taking away our scientific endeavor, taking away our USAID, taking away our Medicaid, our Social Security. That's the immigrant that's hurting us. Immigrant billionaires are hurting us. Elon Musk, Rupert Murdoch, Peter Thiel, these are the guys hurting us. These people that are running from war-torn countries, seeking asylum for the fact that they're gay or they won't join a gang, looking to provide a better life for themselves and their kids, are doing nothing but contribute to this country, making this country better, filling the jobs that Americans, frankly, won't take. And they're going to find that out. Boy, if they're successful in this, scaring all the immigrants away. In fact, immigrant communities should just stage one day where none of them come in. All just a day without a Mexican. Remember that movie? Have everybody just walk off the job, and let's just see how expensive those strawberries get. Just see how many of those dishes pile up at the restaurant. See how many cars don't get washed and lawns don't get cut. But they promised mass deportations now. Stephen Miller and the Project 2025 guys, mass deportations now. Millions of immigrants, because it's not about controlling crime for them. It's not the fear that there's going to be murders and rapes. Not the fear that they're coming to take our jobs. None of that. It's good old-fashioned ethnic cleansing. Blood and soil nationalism. A mistaken belief that America is a country for white Christian men. And to some extent, I can see where they get that. I mean, if you are an originalist and you look back to the 18th century when the Constitution was written, it was written for white Christian men. But that's the beauty of America, and what real Americans understand about America is that America is not about what it was. We don't need to make America great again, because America's not yet achieved its true greatness. America gets better every decade as we progress, as we strive to those ideals of a more perfect union and all men are created equal, and that they're all endowed with inalienable rights, that among these, not limited to, among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not happiness itself, but just the act of pursuing it. We're always striving. This is a country built on the idea of ambition and improvement. And so the country improved when black men were given the vote and become citizens, and improved when women were given the vote and given more rights to full citizenship, and when gay people are included, and when trans people are included, and Native people are included, and disabled people are included. All of that is contributing to the more perfect union and making us a stronger, better country. But not in the minds of MAGA. To them, this was a country founded by white men for white men, where white men had the power to steal all the land from the natives that were there, steal all the labor from the black people that they imported and the Chinese people that they imported, and to subjugate the women, have the babies, and cook the food. And that's the ideal they're striving for again. That's where they wish to take us. And they do so through this demonization and fear-mongering of taking one criminal case of someone like whoever the guy was that killed Lake and Riley, and applying that to every brown-skinned person who immigrated. Notice it doesn't work the other way around, though, that when a white-skinned guy like, say, Dylann Roof goes and murders a bunch of black people in a church, we don't ascribe that violence to all white people, do we? We don't say it's all white young kids that are disgruntled, murderous loners. Those are all single lone wolf mental health problems. But when it's a brown-skinned immigrant who murders and kills or rapes and murders a woman, then it's all the immigrants who have to go. We have to cleanse the country of all the brown-skinned people. It's the most un-American thing possible. They do all this demonization, scaremongering about immigrant communities who statistically have less crime, commit less crime than native-born Americans. Why? Well, because they're undocumented. And if they have any interface with police, they get sent home. They get deported. They want to have less crime. But when you ratchet up this anti-immigrant sentiment, you actually do create more crime, not amongst the immigrants, but just generally speaking, because now immigrants won't call 911. They won't call help. They won't report things. They don't want to interface with the cops. The illegality in the phrase illegal immigrants is a civil matter. Okay? When I think of the frame of people in this country who are undocumented, I put it in the frame of someone who didn't renew or apply for their America license. It's a violation on par with not having a proper license, practicing medicine without a license, driving a car without a license, selling real estate without a license. It's a violation of rules. It's not a violation of morals. In the legal world, they have a couple terms: malum prohibitum and malum in se. Okay, and these are Latin terms. Malum prohibitum means it's bad because it's against the rules. Malum in se means it's bad because it's evil. It's bad in and of itself. Even if there weren't a rule against it, it is bad. Like rape or murder, fraud, theft. Things that we can all agree are crimes that have victims. There is no victim in the civil matter of not properly applying to enter the United States. They keep trying to come up with some harm that this causes. Oh no, they're taking Medicare or emergency room facilities or whatever, which is just an extension of how they don't care about any of us citizens in that regard either. Like, I heard clips from Rick Scott this week talking about, well, if you're not going to work, why should we feed you or help you or give you Medicare? Because they don't care about people. Their whole perspective is you're on your own. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. All men are an island. That's the conservative view. But someone didn't get their America license. Someone didn't fill out a piece of paperwork. That's not reason to separate them from their family, to leave their kids crying. I was going to play this clip. I can't do it because it'll make me cry when I do the podcast. But there's a clip going around of, it must be filmed from the perspective inside of a house where someone's taking care of the kids while they can see out the window the military-clad, rifle-bearing ICE Gestapo hauling off dad in handcuffs, Hispanic dad in handcuffs. And you see and you hear the little Hispanic kids crying in Spanish. Mi papa, mi papa. And I can't even talk about it. Shit. I was going to play it. I can't even fucking talk about this thing without welling up here. Because those could be my grandkids. I don't have any kids of my own, but my lady love has kids. And through those kids, she has I've got four like Hispanic grandkids and a couple Hispanic great grandkids. And in each case, one of the parents is undocumented. And so I hear that clip, and it could be my grandkids. It could be the kids that I took to the train museum and took to the park and stuff. Anyway, that's what this is all about. This is about destroying families and ripping apart lives. And these ICE Gestapo are on the wrong side of history, and these National Guard that are being called up, I sure hope they understand that their duty is to the Constitution and not to the Trump regime, and that they recognize they're being called on to execute illegal orders if they're being called on to do law enforcement in the United States of America against American citizens. Someone not getting their American license is just a civil matter. It's not a crime. And one more thing before I leave this segment. Throughout this Battle of LA thing, Trump's been posting against the mayor of LA and the governor of California. And every time he does so, he refers to the governor of California as Governor Gavin Newsom. Governor Newsom. Because, you know, Trump and his little nickname thing, right? Which, you know, Trump's going to be Trump. I understand that. But I also saw this week a clip where it showed Trump on the tarmac, just having landed with Air Force One, being greeted by Governor Newsom. And there they are, the tarmac, shaking hands and talking to each other. And Trump's doing his little, you know, macho, I can pull your hand move during the handshake. And I just can't help but think, how do you, as governor of California, read these posts coming out calling you Governor Newsom, and then when you're together in public having this face-to-face discussion as if we're just, you know, leaders talking to each other one-on-one? You know, same kind of thing we saw with, you know, Biden welcoming Trump into the Oval Office after weeks of calling him a fascist on the campaign trail. He's a fascist, going to overturn American democracy, be a dictator, and then, let's shake hands and do a peaceful transfer of power. How does anybody who's in a leadership position, who's been in that place of being insulted by Donald Trump on a regular basis, how do they not at some point in front of cameras live go, hey, and you know what? One more thing, President Trump, what's with this calling me Governor Newsom on your posts? Can't you have at least some modicum of respect for the elected leader of the fourth largest economy in the world, the largest U.S. state, you have to give him some fucking juvenile nickname like you're on an eighth grade playground? What the fuck is wrong with you, you idiot? I just once, I would just like one person, a mayor, a congressman, a governor, somebody that he's insulted like this, to live call him out on it. ABC News, on the behest of the Trump regime, has suspended its journalist Terry Moran. Apparently, he put out a tweet pointing out how Donald Trump and Stephen Miller are consumed by hate. I don't think this is a controversial thing to note. I think there's plenty of evidence to document that, but Terry Moran posted that late at night and then deleted it shortly thereafter, but it was on the internet and it was caught by the White House. Their main spokesliar, Carolyn Leavitt, called him out in the White House briefing, saying how awful it was, you know, saying these terrible things. And ABC News has capitulated. They're obeying the tyrannist and suspended Terry Moran, saying he's being too subjective. His remarks were way too subjective. Actually, it says, quote, ABC News stands for objectivity and impartiality in its news coverage and does not condone subjective personal attacks on others. This post does not reflect the views of others at ABC News and violated our standards. As a result, Terry Moran has been suspended pending further evaluation. So I've been following this a bit, checked up on this story and people's reactions to it, like, we need more of this. We need more of journalists actually calling out the truth in these situations, not both citing things, actually looking out the window and seeing whether it's raining, not just taking people's word for it. And there are situations where this is necessary. And if we'd had a little bit more of this, calling a spade, instead of whitewashing and sane washing what Trump says from the media, we might not be in the position we are today. You know, Trump will go off and say some crazy shit at the West Point gathering about, you know, trophy wives and all that other stuff. And then the headline in the New York Times will be, you know, Trump supports a strong military, right? Like, yeah, he may have said one line in there about a strong military and you completely ignore all the rest of the crazy that he said. We need more Terry Morans speaking truth to power. And I'll give you an example. That's my dog. I'll give you an example. 27 days after I was born, 27 days old I was, when a journalist went on the air on his national news network broadcast, and he said, quote, tonight we'd like to sum up our findings in Vietnam, an analysis that must be speculative, personal, and subjective. We have been too often disappointed by the optimism of the American leaders to have faith any longer in the silver linings they find in the darkest clouds. For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. It is increasingly clear to this reporter that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who did the best they could. End quote, with a few edits for brevity. End quote, Walter Cronkite, CBS Evening News. Damn good thing the network heads of ABC News weren't in charge back then when Walter Cronkite was making his subjective analysis of the failure of the leadership in Vietnam for having their magical thinking to finding all their silver linings in the clouds of the Tet Offensive that had occurred on the day I was born 27 days earlier. Yeah, good thing. We need more Walter Cronkites. We need more Terry Morans. We need more of a informed, subjective analysis about what's going on. It's not as if the other side doesn't do that every day. Every day on Fox News. OANN. Right Side Broadcasting Network. Newsmax. Who knows how many other different podcasts out there. The right wing has an entire media news ecosystem constantly analyzing, evaluating, and being subjective about what's going on the news. Now, they're wrong, they're lying, but they constantly analyze and digest complex issues for their audience who, let's face it, don't have the background and intellect necessary to properly analyze these things. And that's not a knock on them. Most people don't. Hell, I don't. We need more informed people, intelligent, educated people to look at complex situations, go, hey, you know what? This looks a lot like this. This looks like fascism. This looks like hate. Kudos to Terry Moran. And speaking of that, speaking of networks speaking truth to power, we see this week that Kilmar Abrego Garcia was released. Released from the notorious CECOP prison in El Salvador and brought back to the United States of America for trumped up charges on, I don't know, somehow he's a human trafficker now, apparently. Fine, bring him back to the country and let's give him due process. That's what we've always wanted. It's just amazing to me how they credulously repeated the talking points of the administration about Abrego Garcia being stuck down there and under the jurisdiction of El Salvador, and there's no way we could possibly bring him back. And then the minute they actually bring him back, they've just moved on to the next subject without confronting all the administration people that, hey, you said you couldn't bring him back. Now you can bring him back. So were you lying? Were you lying back then? And how about all these other guys that you say you can't bring back? Are you still lying now? Because apparently you can bring people back. Well, that subject just kind of faded into the background with all these other cases that are going on. But let's not forget it here at the Radical Rush Show. All right, let's take a moment to focus some of my ire on the Republican Party. They've been up to all sorts of no good this last week. And let's start with Iowa Senator Joni Ernst, who's got to be more excited than anybody this week about the eruption of protests in Los Angeles, taking her off the front page. As you remember from last week, she made news when at a town hall meeting, protesters there at the town hall meeting were worried. I shouldn't say protesters, attendees. At the meeting, we're worried that the cuts to Medicaid coming in the big, beautiful, face-eating leopards bill were going to lead to people dying. And, of course, her response was, well, we're all going to die. And then we told you how she followed that up with a video, a film from a cemetery, where she went on about how naive her constituents were in thinking people were going to die because everybody's going to die. We all die. We're all mortal. And she was happy she didn't have to break the news about the Tooth Fairy because they're all just naive little youngsters and how they should all follow Jesus if they want eternal life, right? So we get you caught up there, right? You remember that? Well, she tripled down. She followed that double down with a triple down, and it got lost because of all the Trump. First, it was the Trump-Musk breakup. We'll talk about that in a second. And then the whole L.A. thing going ablaze. She tripled down. She put out a tweet that reads, quote, sorry if the truth hurts, libs, but yes, we're all gonna die someday. That's biology, not policy. You want Medicaid to save you from mortality? Try a job and a multivitamin. I grew up castrating hogs, not crying at town halls. Hashtag death is natural. Hashtag entitlement addicts. Hashtag hog tough. This is what they believe. They say it out in the open. And Terry Moran gets suspended for calling them haters? Come on. This absolute disdain for her constituents. You want Medicaid to save you from mortality? Yeah. That's what healthcare is for. Saving us from premature mortality. Try a job and a multivitamin. That this insult again, that somehow people on Medicaid are mooches, when we know so many people who are on Medicaid, who are on food stamps, who are on Section 8 housing, who are working. They work for Walmart. They work for Amazon. They work for some of these multi-billion dollar multinational corporations that don't pay them enough to be able to afford that stuff on their own. They give them so few hours or don't pay them enough that they actually do qualify for these programs because they don't have enough money for healthcare and food and housing. Sorry if the truth hurts, conservatives, but if you want to get people off of Medicare rolls, off of SNAP rolls, off of Section 8 housing, companies are going to have to provide more pay. You're going to have to let unions thrive to be able to fight for more pay so people can get paid. It's not like, now look, there are going to be some people who are useless to capitalism. Who are bums, who are losers, slackers, whatever, who are perfectly healthy. But you know what? Most of those people are in a situation, they got a mental health issue that's going to prevent them from being able to work. Regardless, there's going to be some people for whom capitalism does not work. They are not good workers in any way. They have no way that they can work a job. The Republican position is those people should die. If you're not going to play in the capitalism game, if you're not going to work, now leave aside the people who actually do work and still can't afford this stuff. But their idea is, in their little utopia, everybody has a job and everybody works that can afford their own health care and afford their own house and their own food. And the government doesn't have to help anybody except the really sick, the actually sick people that we care about and the really disabled people. Of course, that won't last long either, but that's their mind. Their mind is there's people that deserve it and people that don't. There are some people who deserve to live, people who work, or people who through no fault of their own cannot. Those people deserve to live. And the people who can't work through no fault of their own, they don't deserve to live a great life, you know, bare minimum subsistence life. But if you're not useful to capitalism, you deserve to die. That's their belief. You deserve to die. And if you complain about it, you're a whiner, you're a crier, you should go out on a farm and cut the balls off of pigs. I guess is her point. Entitlement addicts. Well, first of all, Senator Ernst, Social Security is something we pay into, so it's not an entitlement. It's actually an insurance program that we purchased already. Medicare and Medicaid are something we contribute our taxes to provide services to the rest of the people. And Joni Ernst, as a farmer growing up farms, Iowa, you grew up on farm subsidies your whole life. Those farms would have gone under without that welfare from the federal government. It's some reason it's okay for people who can't make it. The people who can't make it, they should be kicked off the government welfare. But businesses that can't make it, farm businesses, other businesses we give subsidies to, for some reason it's okay to give them welfare. So Joni Ernst grew up taking the corporate welfare of farm subsidies and now, as a United States senator, has government health care. For the rest of her life, even when she's out of the Senate, she will have government health care for the rest of her life. So, good enough for me, but not for thee. Oh, and I mentioned the Trump-Musk breakup. Yeah, I'll hold my fire on that one a little bit because I don't think they really broke. I think this is a ploy. I think it's a game. It's all a game. Musk needs his Tesla stock to go up. Trump wants his billionaire friends to make money. They pose a little fight. Tesla stock plummets. Trump's friends buy the dip. By the end of the week, Musk is back retweeting Donald Trump. Ooh, Donald Trump's a pedophile in the Epstein files. Yeah, like, tell us something we don't already know. Well, like, that was the big reveal. Ooh, he called him a pedo. Yeah, like, surprise. It was kind of fun to see the Bernie Sanders take on this, where he says, Elon Musk says the big, beautiful face-eating leopard's bill is an abomination and should be voted against. Well, that's true. Donald Trump says the best way to balance, one of the best ways to balance the budget would be to take away all the government contracts from Elon Musk. I guess we can agree with both of them. Hooray! And, oh, the face-eating leopard's bill, that's the other thing. I'm loving all these Republican reps now, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, well, I didn't know it contained something that said states couldn't regulate AI for 10 years. Well, I didn't know this was in the bill. I didn't read that part of the bill. I didn't know that part of the bill. I didn't know that the leopards would eat my face, says the woman who voted for the face-eating leopards bill. It's kind of nice that this is revealed just how enthralled the Republican Party is to Donald Trump, that they're not even reading bills. Oh, Trump said to vote for it, then we're going to vote for it. Well, I think this is going to run into some great opposition in the U.S. Senate. Rand Paul's already speaking out against it. He can only lose 3 votes in the Senate, and it's back to the House for reconciliation. We'll see if some of these Republicans stand up against it. This is the only thing on Trump's mind legislatively. And really, I don't think the big parts of it, of the tax cuts for the wealthy and the cuts to the Medicaid and Social Security and all that, those are bad. But what's tucked in there that he really likes in the face-eating leopard's bill? Neutering the courts. These bills have in them clauses that neuter the ability of the federal courts to hold administration officials in contempt, which is the only tool judges have to enforce their orders. If you can't hold administration officials in contempt, then a court's just a debating society. It has no power. They also, in this face-eating leopard's bill, have it set up so that a district court or circuit court can't have a nationwide injunction against a law. As it stands now, the president can issue some executive order or declaring something, and people in throughout the 50 states can sue over this if they have standing to say this is unconstitutional. Say it comes up in the Fifth Circuit Court, and the Fifth Circuit Court says, yeah, that's unconstitutional. We're going to put a nationwide injunction on it. So one circuit court for the entire country put a veto on this thing being unconstitutional, and we have, I think, 13 circuit courts, 12 in the D.C., something like that. So there's a lot of places throughout the country that can act as a stop or at least a speed bump on the road to fascism. Well, got to clear that speed bump, don't we? So they want to take away the ability of these courts to make nationwide injunctions. They'd only be able to make an injunction in their district. So Trump says something illegal. Somebody in San Francisco sues. It goes to the Ninth Circuit Court. Ninth Circuit Court says that's unconstitutional. Well, only on the West Coast. It'll only count in the Ninth Circuit. They can continue being unconstitutional over there in Oklahoma and Arkansas and Virginia and Maine and everywhere else. So imagine the practical results of that, should this law pass, is basically you're going to have different federal laws throughout the country based on whichever circuit you live in. You live in the blue Ninth Circuit, then yeah, you might have freedom of speech and freedom of religion and those kind of things, but you live in the Texas Fifth Circuit, well, you might not have any rights at all. This is no way to run a country. All right, now let's turn to my left and focus a little my ire on the Democratic Party, where we had the vote for the big, beautiful face-eating leopard's bill the other week, and it was 215 to 214. And on the podcast, I noted how the Democrats had lost some votes as of late because of 3 Democrats this Congress who have died in office, all in their 70s. And I think all of them had cancer. Something I think all three did. But who all died in office, despite their age and their infirmity, that could have been three more votes against the bill, which could have forced other Republicans to have to go on the record, yada, yada, yada. But as I discussed this on the podcast last week, after the conclusion of the podcast, I started thinking more about it. And I just wondered, you know, what were the actual stats? Like, how many Democrats have died in Congress this century? Because it seems to be a lot of them. You know, I remember Dianne Feinstein, right? She was being propped up, didn't even know where she was half the time. So how many have died in office this century compared to the Republicans? And I came up with some startling numbers here. So there were 45 members of Congress since the year 2000. 45 of them have died in office. 30 of those were Democrats. That's right. Two out of every three people in Congress to die this century were Democrats. 30 Democrats, 15 Republicans. Now, the average age of all 45 of them who've died in Congress was age 74. Average age, 19 of them. Oh, I'm sorry. Of the Democrats, that's not of all of them, excuse me. The median age for all of them was 73. Okay. So of all 45 of them, median age was 73. Of those 30 Democrats who've died since the year 2000 while still in the House or the Senate, the average age was 74. 19 of them, 19 of the 30, were over the age of 70. Two were over the age of 90 when they died in office. And of the 25 years since the year 2000, there's only been seven of those years where no Democrat died in office. Compare that to the GOP. 15 of the 45 members were GOP, or Republicans. Their average age was 69, so 5 years younger than the average age of the Democrats who died in office. So, in a sense, more unexpected deaths, right? Because, like, over the age of 70, it's not unexpected to die. Under the age of 70, it's kind of like a surprise. So, average age 69. There were only seven of them, of the 15, who were over the age of 70. There were none of them over the age of 90 because Chuck Grassley inexplicably still continues to breathe. The Republicans have suffered no deaths in Congress since 2022. And 16 of the 25 years of this century, they've had no deaths at all. So to put it another way, there were more Democrats age 74 or older who died in Congress this century than all of the Republicans of any age who died in Congress this century. 19 Democrats were age 74 or older. There were only 15 Republicans total who died in office. So that's something to think about, Democratic Party. Take a look at your seniority. Take a look at some of your senior leadership there. And make the tough decision to hang it up, especially if you've got some health problems. But it's not just age that's a problem with the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party suffers an extreme epidemic of not believing in anything. You got to stand for something. You got to believe in something. I see that they've put together, some Democratic consultants have put together this thing called Searchlight, where they're going to seek out broadly popular positions to get the Democrats behind. Broadly popular positions Democrats should get behind. Well, yeah, that's how you achieve power. That's how you achieve loyalty. That's how you achieve dedication. Find out which way the wind is blowing and support that. You know, like the Republicans did when for 50 years they supported the broadly popular position of abortion bans. No, those aren't broadly popular, are they? In fact, just about everything you can look at that the Republicans support is not broadly popular. And by contrast, the things that Democrats historically have supported are union membership is now popular. Abortion rights is popular. Legalizing weed is popular. Raising the minimum wage is popular. Stand for those things. But no, you get these searchlight people saying we got to find out what's popular and go with that instead of believing something and then making it popular, leading, standing for something and educating the public onto why it's important. That's what we need from Democrats. But no, you get guys like Ro Khanna, who's supposed to be super lefty progressive Ro Khanna, who in the wake of this whole Trump Musk bitch fest said, quote, "We should ultimately be trying to convince him that the Democratic Party has more of the values that he agrees with. That we should court Elon Musk to support the Democrats. Hey, you know that drugged up South African Nazi senti billionaire who gleefully condemned millions to die without U.S. aid, wrecked the administrative state, and has a dozen baby mamas and disowns his trans daughter? We should get him on our side." Are you fucking kidding me? The Nazi salute alone is disqualifying. You kicked Al Franken out of the Senate for a fake boob grab photo, but you want to take money from Elon Nazi salute Musk? Richie Torres, when Elon Musk said that this big, beautiful face-eating leopards bill was an abomination, Richie Torres, California Democrat, says, quote, "I'm a believer in redemption." And he is telling the truth about the legislation. Because what? Because we want that fat donation check from Elon Musk. All about the money. And that's where I get to this point about Democrats just believe in something. For instance, campaign finance. We all agree there shouldn't be big money in campaigns. There shouldn't be all this dark money, these super PACs. But once Citizens United passes, the Democratic Party is just as much awash in super PAC money as the Republican Party. Well, that's the rules of the game. We have to fight the way the rules are played now. No! No! Take a stand and say this corporate super PAC dark money stuff is wrong, and we as a party, individually and collectively, will not take it. And we will only support ourselves through small money individual donors. Oh, yeah, Russ, you do that, you're going to lose billions in money, you won't have ad campaigns, blah, 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 blah. Well, yeah, we had, what, $100 million for Kamala Harris, and we had all sorts of money to spend on the Las Vegas Sphere, and how'd that turn out? All the money in the world for ad campaigns isn't going to work if you haven't got a product to sell it with. And that product needs to have integrity. Barack Obama pioneered this with the small money donors back in 2008. It's shown that it can work. But you'd have to actually take the risk. You'd have to stand for something and take the risk that you might lose in the short term by standing for it, like the Republicans did with abortion. So stand for something. We're not going to take any big money donors anymore. We're the party of anti-corruption. No more corruption. We are going to forbid all of the members of the Democratic Party from having individual stock portfolios. They can be in hedge funds, they can be, you know, in mutual funds, those kind of things. But you can't trade individual stocks. Even if Congress won't pass such a law that we can't trade individual stocks, we as Democrats will voluntarily stop selling individual stocks. We'll sell our entire stock portfolio of individual stocks to make the point that we are not the party of corruption. Nancy, we're the party that believes in civil rights, that everyone has the right to a fair vote, that gerrymandering is wrong. But what does the Democratic Party do in New York State? They gerrymander the hell out of New York State to favor Democrats. They do the same thing in other blue states. If gerrymandering is wrong when the Republicans are doing it in Texas, then it's wrong when the Democrats do it in New York. And once again, the people say, well, Russ, if we don't gerrymander our states, then they're going to have more legislators. And then we have to take the risk that if we gave everyone a free and fair vote, we might not win them all because we believe in democracy. Stand up against gerrymandering and don't do it in our states. Anti-war. Are we a party that is against war except to defend ourselves? Except to defend our allies? Are we a party that's anti-genocide? Just this week, the UN had a vote, the Security Council had a vote on an unconditional ceasefire in Gaza. The United States was the lone veto. But do you think it would have been any different under a Democratic president? We saw how much the Biden administration was more than eager to keep sending bombs and bullets. Keep sending bombs and bullets over to Israel to continue to use on their ethnic cleansing campaign of utter destruction of Gaza. Democrats can't even say the G word. Can't dare call it genocide. Can't piss off AIPAC. Can't piss off the big money. Which again, if you were a party that stood for something and said you'd only take small dollar donations, you wouldn't have to fear what the fuck AIPAC has to say about any of this. You'd be able to stand for the principle that genocide is wrong, even when it's done by our white allies, especially when it's done by our white colonizing allies. David Sirota made a good point about this online on Blue Sky, and I have to paraphrase it because I don't have the exact quote in front of me. But it was basically that there's a lot of reasons you can trace for the decline of the Democratic Party. But one big picture element you got to take out of it is that the Democratic Party had a lock on Congress for about 40 years or so, from FDR all the way up until Newt Gingrich. So yeah, it's about 40, 50 years that the Democratic Party was largely in control of this country when it was a New Deal party, when it was a Civil Rights Act party, when it was standing for the ideals of the Constitution to make this country a more perfect union. And that all changed when Ronald Reagan came in, kicked their ass three elections in a row. Well, Reagan and Bush, three elections in a row. And the Democratic Party abandoned its ideals of being the party of the poor, sidled up to big money in the Clinton administration, started talking about the end of welfare as we know it. Let's do what business wants to do. Let's ship our jobs overseas with NAFTA. Let's go after the medical marijuana providers in California, try to shut them down. People forget the Clinton administration did that too. Actually threatened the free speech rights of doctors to be able to try to stop medical marijuana. And what do you know? Ever since the 90s, ever since the party abandoned its principles of standing for the poor, the downtrodden, the immigrant, the picked on, the underdog, and sidled up to big money, sidled up to big business, sidled up to the military-industrial complex, what do you know? Democrats have lost favor to the point now where they're at their lowest approval rating ever. With one blip in the middle, the 2009-2010 portion of Barack Obama's first term, who, you'll remember, ran as the outsider, ran as an actual Democrat, talking about hope and change and legalizing drugs and helping people that needed help. He ran as a progressive populist. He displaced Hillary Clinton, who was continuing the neoliberal 90s legacy DNC third way Democrat betrayal of her husband's. There is an opportunity in this Trump regime, in this nightmare that we're living through here. Should we actually get to have free and fair elections? There is such the opportunity for a Democratic leader to stand for something, to stand for Democratic ideals, to reject the third way 90s democratic neoliberalism and lead a massive movement. I think the backlash to Trumpism for the Democratic Party could be as big and as impactful a change for the Democratic Party as the reaction to the Reagan landslide ass kickings was. This could be a transformative moment for the Democratic Party. But we're going to have to hold them to account on that. We're going to have to force them to, because as it's looking right now, I don't think they're getting the message. Look at what's happening in New York State with Andrew Cuomo. There's a decent chance that Andrew Cuomo is going to be the next mayor of New York City after being ousted by New York State as their governor, after several credible, terrible accusations of sexual assault and misconduct. Here we are trying to sell the Democratic brand, and in its biggest state, we have Newsom out there platforming Charlie Kirk and Steve Bannon, and talking about adding work requirements for Medicaid, again, pulling Clintonian, the end of welfare as we know it stuff. Boy, if we just agree with the Republicans' frame and show how that we can do it better than the Republicans would, why, then people will support us. Instead of being an opposite of the Republicans, being on the other side of the issue than the Republicans. And then in our biggest blue city, we got Democrats possibly going to elect Andrew Cuomo after the second biggest blue state kicked him to the curb for being a sexual pest. And oh, love the silence from Kirsten Gillibrand on the issue. Love how Kirsten Gillibrand hasn't weighed in on this sexual assaulter, possibly being given a high office in her state, being given leadership of the largest city in our country. Not a word from Kirsten Gillibrand asking whether or not the women working in his office might feel safe. Awfully silent, Kirsten. I think I mentioned last podcast that we are in the middle of Pride Month, Gay Pride Month, and I'll just say happy Pride to everyone again this week, and a shout out to the folks in Canyon County, my home county of Idaho, where they are having their second annual Pride celebration. And folks, having grown up in Canyon County, the notion of there being a Pride celebration in Nampa, Idaho, blows my mind. It got covered by the Washington Post last year. And when they covered it last year, they noted how the mayor, Debbie Kling, mayor of Nampa, Idaho, tried to stop it from happening and got quoted as saying, well, it's something me and the city council don't believe in or agree with. I forget exactly how she phrased it. But our lawyers said because of the First Amendment, we have to let it go on. And basically, we think the gays are icky, but they got First Amendment rights too, so we can't stop them. So very brave of the man to have the Pride event there. And I guess it's taking place, took place again this weekend. And so in celebration of that, and congratulations to those folks, this week I'm not going to do a Boycott Idaho segment. I've got no reason to boycott Idaho this weekend since they went and had a Pride celebration in my hometown. So we'll just let that be. But I have other Pride news that I wanted to get to, and the shocking one, of course, this week was the murder of beloved voice actor, Native American Jonathan Joss. He was the voice of John Redcorn on King of the Hill. Always loved that character. And I guess he was on Parks and Recreation as well. And the terrible story of how he's been accosted by his neighbors, who've been yelling homophobic slurs, and just they've had, you know, Hatfield and McCoy bad neighbor kind of situation going on where they lived. And they've been going through some problems, some poverty. He and his husband were experiencing some poverty. Their power was out for a while and such. But apparently a bad situation exacerbated by the fact that the neighbors were quite homophobic and did not want to have the couple in their neighborhood. Exemplified by the fact that apparently Joss's home was burned down by arson. And there's conflicting reports about whether or not this has been confirmed as being an arson attack or being a hate crime, that it was necessarily because of homophobia. But come on, two out gay men living together who are getting into regular fights with neighbors who are yelling homophobic things at them, and then their house mysteriously burns down. Okay. So their house burned down and they were going there to, you know, pick through it. And they find their dog's head. Somebody had decapitated their dog and taken the dog's head with the leash still around the neck part and hung it from their still standing mailbox. So Joss and his husband are there at the mailbox freaking out, as you would if you found your pet decapitated at the site of your burned down home. They're crying and screaming about it. When the neighbor comes out with the gun, yells some homophobic slurs at them, raises the gun toward them, Joss pushes his husband out of the way and gets gunned down there in the street by the homophobic neighbor. And then the first reports that came out from the San Diego Police Department are like, oh, we have no evidence that there was any homophobic hate crime involved here. Despite the husband giving a firsthand account online of what I just told you about how they found the head and the neighbor comes out and is yelling homophobic slurs and shot the guy in broad daylight. So gay people are being literally erased, killed, murdered in this country. And the media reports on it like actor passes away after neighbor involved shooting. Always soft pedaling it, always sane washing it. We see the use of the exonerative tense that's usually reserved for when cops kill people, apparently now gets extended to when homophobes kill people as well. Rest in peace, Jonathan Joss, and condolences to your husband and all the people you loved. It's just terrible. And not only gay people being literally erased in this country, they're being figuratively erased in this country. We get the news this week that the Secretary of Defense, Hegseth, is that his name? Hegseth, that's it, Hegseth. Secretary of Defense Hegseth has ordered the removal of the names Harvey Milk and Medgar Evers from Navy ships. Yeah, removing the names of prominent gay activists who served our country in the military, for God's sake. Medgar Evers was on Omaha Beach 81 years ago, the Battle of Normandy. But Kegsbreath says, oh, we got to restore the warrior ethos, the fighting ethos, because, you know, gay men, that's all fancy, pansy, limp-wristed day. That's not warrior ethos. Are you fucking kidding me? Gay people have served with distinction and honor in the United States Armed Forces. There are gay Medal of Honor winners. Medgar Evers fought. Not only did he fight at Omaha Beach, then he comes back to the United States of America, becomes one of the most prominent civil rights activists as a black gay man trying to fight for his rights. Harvey Milk fought in the United States military and then comes back to become a supervisor in the city of San Francisco, murdered by one of his fellow supervisors. It was his murder that ended up elevating Dianne Feinstein to her first position as mayor. But Kegsbreath doesn't believe that gay people fit under the warrior ethos, and trans people have already been kicked out of the military. Apparently only straight males can fight for this country. Look, I served in the military, and I don't often, you know, put any brag on that. I was in the freaking National Guard band, okay? But I served in the National Guard band with a gay soldier. He was my section leader, a flute player named Kelly. And he was gay. Like, you know, don't ask, don't tell. Not even necessary. like this was, oh, hello. This was, don't ask, didn't have to ask. It was all told. Like, there was no shock or surprise that Kelly was gay. And nobody cared. Nobody cared. We all wore the same camouflage. We all shined the same boots. We all had to do the same PT run every year. We all had to do the same rifle training. And he was a really good shot, by the way. Kelly was an amazing shot. So give me a break with this de-gayifying the military so that it has some sort of warrior ethos. You obviously haven't read your history about Sparta, about Romans and their sexual proclivities. They seem to have quite the warrior ethos then. In fact, part of their warrior ethos was homosexual love, with the idea that you would fight greater for someone that you loved. It's a shame what these people are doing to the military. Well, the country baseline means it's time for my Boycott Idaho segment. But as I mentioned, I'm not going to do a Boycott Idaho segment today in celebration of Pride, and specifically Canyon County Pride that took place this weekend. Congratulations on having that for a second straight year. Instead, I'm going to take this time to delve into music a little bit. We get so serious about politics all the time. So let me just give you a little music trivia, because I'm a part of this little group on Blue Sky that migrated over from Twitter X that has a little club we call AT40. And what it is on the 70s on 7 channel on Sirius XM, they replay the old Casey Kasem American Top 40 show from this week in one of the weeks in the 1970s. So, you know, 1 year it'll be 1975, 1 year it'll be 1971, whatever, but it's from the same week of that particular year in the 70s. And so this last week, when we had our little hashtag AT40 gig, it was 1975. Top 40 for 1975 included the song How Long by Ace. You know that song? How long has this been going on? That song? It got to number 3 on that week, last week, back in 1975. And the song features the lead vocals of the wonderful Paul Carrack, who went on to sing the song Tempted for the group Squeeze, and then went on to join Mike and the Mechanics later on in the 80s. They went to number 1 with The Living Years. And then Paul Carrack, as a solo artist, went and had a hit, went to number 9 with a single called Don't Shed a Tear. And I thought, you know, while we were on AT40, I put up the comment, like, what an amazing feat that is to have been the lead singer on 3 different hits with 3 different bands and have a hit as a solo artist. There can't be too many singers who have hit such a home run. Well, once I opened that can of worms, there was a discussion in my replies on my social media account with suggestions of other artists who would count. Like, how many artists out there that have been in 3 successful bands and a successful solo career? Well, somebody brought up Paul McCartney, right? Well, he had Paul McCartney, you know, with the Beatles, of course. Then Paul McCartney and Wings, right? And then he had solo hits as Paul McCartney. And then he had a duet hit with Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder. Would that count? And then another person brought up Eric Clapton. Like, do we only count singer if they actually sung on the hit song? Because in that case, you got, you know, Eric Clapton was in Cream. He sang songs with Cream, sure. Eric Clapton with the Yardbirds, though, and Eric Clapton with Derek and the Dominoes, did he sing on those hits? And then there's Eric Clapton solo, right? But did he actually sing on the hits? Would they count? Well, as the discussion went on, I decided we had to have some criteria. We got to set up some rules for what I call home run singers. The first rule is the person has to have been a lead singer on the hit song. We'll call this the Eric Clapton rule. And we have to leave it to singers. Because if you just count musicians who'd had hit in multiple bands, you know, three bands and a soloist, well, then Eric Clapton would get in, but then nobody in the Wrecking Crew would get in. Carole Kaye and all these cats who played on a million hits with a million bands, but then they never had a solo hit, right? Or Toto, like all the guys in Toto, they were session players on a million hits too back in the 70s, but they never had any, you know, solo hits, right? So that's the Eric Clapton rule, because also, fuck Eric Clapton. Rule number 2, the hit song has to have hit the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. You know, we could have counted UK hits and other stuff, but I decided U.S. Billboard Hot 100. I'm going to call this the Paul Carrack rule, because when I first came up with Paul Carrack as the first home run singer, I thought Tempted was a top 40 hit. But when I did my research, I found out that Tempted by Squeeze only made it to number 49 on the U.S. chart. It didn't even make the top 40 in the U.K. It only went to number 41. That's blasphemy. Tempted by Squeeze didn't make the top 40. That's like learning that Elton John's Tiny Dancer was not a top 40 hit, which it wasn't, by the way. Tiny Dancer peaked out at number 41. So that didn't seem right that Paul Carrack wouldn't be included. So I changed it to the Billboard Hot 100. But then that's just pop songs. That doesn't include like the U.S. mainstream rock charts or the U.S. country chart or the U.S. soul chart or the U.S. disco chart. Because then if we started including them, there'd be a whole bunch of people. Like you'd have to add Chris Cornell, because he had Hard Rock Hits with Soundgarden, Audioslave, and Temple of the Dog. You'd have to add Paul Rogers, who had hits with Free, Bad Company, and The Firm, although I don't know if he had any solo hits. Then you got Sammy Hagar. He had hits with Montrose, Van Halen, and a hit with Hagar, Schoen, Aronson, and Shreve when they did Whiter Shade of Pale. And then Steve Winwood. God, you'd have to include Steve Winwood with Spencer Davis Group, Traffic, and Blind Faith. But since they didn't have U.S. Billboard Hot 100 hits, I'm not going to count them. Oh, and also, fuck Eric Clapton. For rule number three, the singer has to have had a hit song with three or more bands, and we're going to define a band as two or more artists who recorded an entire album together. We're going to call this the Graham Nash rule, because does Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young count as a different band than Crosby, Stills, and Nash? It's kind of a tough one because, in a sense, it's really the same band with just one member not in there. I mean, it's not like Tom Johnston's and Michael McDonald's Doobie Brothers are two separate bands, even though one of them left and the other joined and they sounded like two different bands afterwards. And they sound more distinct than Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young and Crosby, Stills & Nash do, but Doobie Brothers is just one band. So for the sake of clarity, if they recorded an album under a different name, they're a different band. For example, Jefferson Airplane, Jefferson Starship, and Starship. Those are three different bands. And, you know, fuck Eric Clapton. And the fourth rule is they must also have a hit song with a solo, single, or a duet single, but having both doesn't give you double credit. We're going to call this the Stevie Nicks rule because, well, I was going to call it the Paul McCartney rule because, you know, that whole idea of Paul McCartney and Wings, Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder, Paul McCartney and the Beatles. But Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder didn't record an entire album together. They weren't a band. So a duet, that doesn't get you in any more than just being Paul McCartney as a solo artist. Because if you did, if you allowed in duets, then you'd have to let Stevie Nicks in as Stevie Nicks and Tom Petty, Stevie Nicks and Don Henley, and Fleetwood Mac. And then that, if we did that, then we're far afield from the idea of three bands and a solo, right? Then at that point, you're talking one band, one solo, and two duets. That doesn't work for me. So you can get credit for your solo hit as a solo artist or as part of a duet, but if you do both, it's still just one credit. And also, sorry about saying fuck Eric Clapton, but he's a bigot, so fuck Eric Clapton. So here we go. With those four rules in mind, you have to be the lead singer on the hit song. The hit song has to hit the Billboard Hot 100. The hit song has to be with three different bands and a hit song as a soloist or a duet. Who are the home run singers in pop music history? And folks, I was shocked to find there's only four. There's only four that I could come up with who sang with three different bands and as a solo artist and hit the Hot 100. Now, Stephen Stills and Graham Nash were pretty easy to come up with. Stephen Stills hit with Buffalo Springfield for What It's Worth, and then he sang lead on Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's Woodstock in 1970, hit number 11. He sang lead on Crosby, Stills & Nash, Southern Cross, number 16 in 1982. And then he had his own solo hit in 1970 with Love the One You're With that went to number 14. Okay, so that he hits all four. And Graham Nash is kind of similar in that Graham Nash hit with Stop, Stop, Stop with the Hollies in 1966. He sang lead on that one, number seven. He sang lead on Marrakesh Express in 1969 with Crosby, Stills, Nash that went to number 28. He sang Just a Song Before I Go with Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young in 1977 that went to number seven. And he had his own solo hit called Chicago back in 1971 that went to number 35. Surprisingly, Neil Young and David Crosby don't make it in. Even though David Crosby was with the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, and Crosby, Stills, Nash, and had a solo hit in a duet with Phil Collins, he didn't sing lead on a song that went to the top 100 with Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. I think Guinevere off of Deja Vu was the one that he sang lead on, and Almost Cut My Hair, and those didn't make the top 100. So kind of surprising. And same thing with Neil Young. He makes it with Buffalo Springfield, but he didn't sing lead. He was with Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, and Neil Young and Crazy Horse, and his own solo Neil Young, but again, he lacks a Hot 100 for Buffalo Springfield. They didn't make it in, but the other two with Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young did. And then, of course, Paul Carrack, we mentioned. He was with Ace, How Long, 1975, went to number three. Squeeze, Tempted, 1981, went to number 49. Mike and the Mechanics, The Living Years, went to number one in 1988. And Don't Shed a Tear, Paul Carrack solo, 1987, went to number nine. So those are your home run singers. But as I was pointing all of these guys out, these three that I could find, right? And there are so many others, like guys like Ronnie James Dio or Sammy Hagar, Chris Cornell, they could have made it if we included rock or, you know, rock charts. Or if we included the country charts, guys like Chris Hillman from Desert Rose Band and Nitty Gritty, the guys from the Byrds, you know, there were other guys that could have made it if we'd included other charts. But you learned the Billboard Hot 100. It's Paul Carrack, Stephen Stills, Graham Nash, and one more guy who not only hit as a solo artist, but hit with not three, not four, but five different bands. The guy, I forget who brought this to my attention on the AT40 list, but thank you for giving this to me because I never would have found this. There's a fellow by the name of Tony Burrows. Never heard of the guy, right? Tony Burrows, singer out of the UK, made the US charts, made number 87. He didn't make it very high on the Hot 100. But in 1970, he had a solo hit called Melanie Makes Me Smile. And also in 1970, hit with Edison Lighthouse, Love Grows Where My Rosemary Goes, number five, White Plains, My Baby Loves Lovin', 1970, went to number 13, Brotherhood of Man, United We Stand, went to number 13, and The Pipkins, Gimme Dat Ding, went to number nine in 1970. So in the year 1970 alone, this guy, Tony Burrows, has a hit top 100 single and four top 20 singles, two top 10s and two top 20s in 1 year as the lead singer. And then follows that up 4 years later in 1974 with a group called The First Class and a song called Beach Baby that went to number four. So that's Tony Burrows, who hit with five different bands and a solo artist, our number one pop music home run singer. The Radical Rant, I want to talk a little bit about the rise of American snitch culture. It's just disgusting what's going on with Trump maladministration and their various law enforcement arms that are setting up these tip lines to get people to report on various things like immigrants that might be out there, you know, working for a living. One of them popped up on my social media feed from the FBI, Kash Patel's FBI, that says, "Help the FBI protect children. As the Attorney General has made clear, we will protect our children and hold accountable those who mutilate them under the guise of gender-affirming care. Report tips of any hospitals, clinics, or practitioners performing these surgical procedures on children at 1-800-CALL-FBI or tips.fbi.gov. Now, what activists have been doing a lot lately is flooding these tips with all sorts of, you know, flack, making sure that they get overwhelmed and they can't actually collect tips on anybody. But I just want to talk about the mindset behind this in the first place. First of all, the gender-affirming care that we're talking about for trans kids is legal in many states. And this push by the federal government to try to criminalize it in states like Idaho that have already criminalized gender-affirming care are quite hypocritical, because if you want me to report on hospitals, clinics, or practitioners who are mutilating kids under the guise of gender-affirming care, I'm going to be really, really busy, because I'm going to have to call in a tip on every hospital and moil in the United States who is circumcising infant boys, aka mutilating them under the guise of gender-affirming care. Yes, that's right. Circumcision is gender-affirming care. Or how about the girls, the teenage girls, who are getting nose jobs? Teenage girls getting nose jobs and boob jobs and all sorts of surgical procedures designed to enhance their femininity, aka gender-affirming care. But no, we won't be going after them, because their gender-affirming care is affirming the gender that aligns with their birth sex. That kind of gender-affirming care is okay. Boy, you want to get some Rogaine for your hairline, gentlemen, so you look more manly? That's okay. That's gender-affirming care, isn't it? This whole demonization of transgender healthcare always shocks me, because we're talking about kids who want the healthcare, parents who want the healthcare, and doctors who want the healthcare. What business is it of anyone else's what that kid, doctor, and their parents want to do? Why is this anyone's business? Why is it up to the government to stop this from happening? To declare at the state level, as a society, that that kid doesn't know what they want, that kid doesn't know who they are, to think that we know better than the parents or the doctors what that kid needs? Whose business is it anyway? We don't seem to have a problem with the parents who approve of their kids joining the tackle football team. The tackle football team, where there's a lot of pressure on young boys to be a football star, to get the girl, to win the trophy, a lot of pressure, a lot of gender-based masculinity pressure, got to join the team, got to be a tough guy, got to be a winner, join the team. Despite these kids not being old enough or mature enough to make a lifelong decision like that, a decision to play a sport that almost inexorably leads to brain damage at some level, to risk chronic traumatic encephalopathy, to risk lifelong changes to one's body and mind. For some reason, in that case, what the parents decide to let the kid do is A-okay. That the kid can take on these lifelong risks to their body and health is just fine. They're fine making that decision. Playing tackle football and risking your brain, that's fine. Taking cross-sex hormones and developing breasts, oh, no, 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 we can't have that. That's what I wish the Democratic Party would say when it comes to these trans issues. I've said it before. When it comes to fighting anti-Semitism, nobody tries to convince me that Jews are God's chosen people. Nobody tries to convince me that Moses parted the Red Sea. Nobody tries to force me to believe that one day's worth of oil lasted for 8 days on the candelabra. I'm not required to subscribe to any Jewish ideology to be against anti-Semitism and to be pro-Jewish inclusion, to recognize their holidays, let's say, if they want to take a day off. So why is it when it comes to defending trans people, were we required to subscribe to all the ideology? Who cares about the ideology? It doesn't matter whether you think the trans boy is just a confused boy or actually a girl in a boy's body. It doesn't matter what you think. What matters is that they think it, and they shouldn't be discriminated against for thinking it any more than we discriminate against Jews for thinking they're chosen people, or we discriminate against Scientologists for thinking Xenu planted thetans in them, or we discriminate against Mormons for thinking they can die and become a god someday. You can believe all sorts of wacky shit, but in America, we celebrate differences and we accept people and we make accommodations for them. We accommodate the Sikh to be able to wear his turban because he believes in that. So why can't we accommodate the trans boy who believes he's female inside? That's where these arguments need to go to. Not trying to force religious people in the middle of America that trans women are women. They will never believe it. They will always believe they're men in dresses. But they're fine with them being men in dresses. The ratings for RuPaul's Drag Race are always successful. People are cool with the living as a woman. They got no problem with it. But it seems to me the transgender movement here for their inclusion and rights comes with the price of agreeing with what they believe about themselves. I don't know if that's something that can actually work in this country. I think we have to accept that people are different. They believe different things. And despite them believing different things we might not agree with or believe in, they have equal rights too. Well, that's all the time we've got this week. The Radical Russ Show is produced, directed, researched, written, recited, posted, and catered by me, Radical Russ Belville, and governed by Creative Commons share-alike licensing. News clips and social media posts are produced under fair use copyright laws for commentary and analysis. My main theme is We Love the Herb by Herbal Nation, and interstitial music is by me, my bass, and my drum machine. And now, our post-credits scene. Back in the late 1800s and 1900s, there was an astronomer at the Royal Astronomy Society named John Belville, and his daughter was the woman who provided time to the city of London. Her name was Ruth Belville, and she was in charge of getting the accurate time from the Greenwich Mean Time clock and storing it on a watch, a chronometer, and then going around to various places and letting them know what the time was. And she did this for 40 years. I'll have a link to it in my show notes, but it's an interesting story about one of my ancestors, and with the last name Belville spelled like mine, which is a pretty rare spelling. So that's kind of neat to see. Also, I wanted to make a note in sports world that Aaron Rodgers, the anti-vax kook and former quarterback of my beloved Green Bay Packers, has been traded, and apparently it looks like he's landing in Pittsburgh with the Pittsburgh Steelers, which is the favorite team of my lady love's ex-husband. All right. Well, Lee, you can have my quarterback. Enjoy him. Have fun. Also, wanted to shout out to my classmates. Nampa High School class of 1985 is having their 40th year reunion at the end of this month, and I'll be making my way back to Nampa, Idaho to participate in the reunion. And they sent out a little questionnaire for a book they're putting together on the class of 85 and what we've been doing over these past 40 years. And the question read, "What have you done over the past 40 years?" And I'm here to tell you the proper answer is not Marijuana, mushrooms, cocaine, ecstasy, acid, oxy, DMT, meth, poppers, cloves, nicotine, and alcohol. That's not the proper answer to what have you done over the past 40 years. That's not what they mean by done, Russ. You can contact me by email at radicalrus@gmail.com. Call my message line at 877-RUSS-420. That's 877-877-420. And reach me on social media on Blue Sky as radicalrus.com and nowhere else. No Twitter, no Instagram, no WhatsApp, no Facebook, no MySpace, no Friendster, no BBS. It's only on Blue Sky if you want to get a hold of me on socials. You can also support this podcast financially by donating to Radical Russ on Venmo, Rad Russ on Cash App, or via PayPal on my website at radicalrus.com. Get this podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, my website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and until next week, take care of each other. Take a seat, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roam it, you smoke it, and it goes down slow.